Good morning. It is about 8 minutes past 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Gene Purcell with you this week, and I'm here filling in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is with us again today for another hour of On Your Money. And as always, we have an awful lot to talk about. If you've got a financial comment or a question for Kevin, here's how you can get in touch with us. Of course, we've got a toll-free phone number. It is 800-642-1234. You can also use email, and that is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney at WPR.org. And let's bring Kevin into the conversation. Kevin McKinley, good morning. Welcome to 2012.
Thank you, Mr. Purcell, and good morning to you, too.
Well, it is great to have you along. And great to have you for the first show of the year. Let's start talking about our paychecks this year, because that is something we always take a look at. And I want to talk about workers' paychecks continuing to be a little bit bigger than usual this year, but it's not because of a bump in pay.
Well, not technically, and not for most people, and only for the next few months. Late last year, there was much debate and rancor about it, but there finally was a small short-term extension of the Social Security tax break for most workers. They contribute 6.2% of their salary to the Social Security and disability system, and then their employers contribute the same amount, 6.2%, up to $110,100 per worker. But last year, we received a 2% break on our side of the contribution, and that means for a worker who was earning about $40,000 per year, they had about an extra $800 or so in their pockets for the entire year to spend as they please. There was a lot of debate about it before it was put in, and then as the deadline came up, there was much more debate about it as well. But as of the time, as of now anyway, it seems it's going to be extended for the first 2 months of the year.
So what was behind the cause for all this controversy?
It's going to be shocking to you and a lot of other listeners, but there was some political pressure on both sides. Yeah, I know. It's finally come to a head here. Politics are starting to actually enter into the topic of discussion on anything about this. The Democrats wanted the extension. Republicans didn't. The Democrats pointed out, they said, a lot of this money would go to workers who were in lower to middle incomes, which is more likely to be spent and more likely to help the economy. Republicans countered and said this will exacerbate the current drain on the Social Security system and the surplus, which is about $2.5 trillion right now. Democrats said, hey, if people are spending more money, that leads to a better economy, which leads to more workers, which leads to more people contributing to the Social Security system. Again, with the political issues coming to a head, they finally compromised near the end of the year. And if I had to guess, I'd say it's probably going to be extended again even after the first of March.
Now, what about those folks who are concerned that cutting the Social Security tax will actually weaken the program?
Well, both sides are actually probably right about the effect of the move. It's a question of, are you more concerned about the problem today or are you more concerned about the problem tomorrow? And like most political issues, this is something where it's more convenient to kick the can down the road, worry about today now, and forget about tomorrow until tomorrow actually comes. We are likely to see more means testing of Social Security and Medicare benefits in the future. And more people will probably pay income taxes on their Social Security benefits when they receive them in retirement. But there are a few things that people can be doing now and in the future so that any tax or any extra means testing might not affect you as much as it otherwise would.
So what can you do?
If you do have some extra money from this temporary cut in your Social Security payroll tax, you may want to use that to actually save for retirement in an at-work plan like a 401k or a 403b. It will not only cut your income tax bill, remember every dollar you can get aside into one of those pre-tax plans reduces your tax bill by about 20 to 30 cents. You also might get a match from your employer. And if you're tight on funds, you can use a Roth IRA. Again, the Roth IRA doesn't provide an upfront tax deduction, but you can pull the contributions back out at any time for any reason whatsoever with no taxes or penalties at all. So it's much helpful for people who are feeling a little tight but want to save for retirement to save for a Roth IRA, save in a Roth IRA instead. Plus, and this is for the time being, distributions from Roth IRAs in retirement do not affect the taxation of Social Security benefits. So if your Social Security checks are coming in and you pull money out of a Roth IRA, the money from the Roth IRA is not going to make the Social Security taxable.
And it sounds as though it'd be a good idea for people to keep an eye on their pay stub for at least the next couple of months.
Absolutely. And there, it's one of the problems, of the many problems in this current political and economic environment. It's bad enough to try to deal with the many problems we are facing. What's worse is when the rules are tentative and they're temporary and they can be changed on almost a month-to-month basis, whereas before it seemed like we had years to adjust and plan for it. Now we, you know, we get 2 months here to decide what we're going to do with this extra money, spend it, save it, and then we don't even know if it will be continued and much less what that dollar amount will be.
All right, we'll keep our eyes open for that. We're going to invite people to give a call in, 800-642-1234. If you'd like to talk to Kevin here on Your Money, 800-642-1234. If you've got a question or a comment. I need to point out that Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. Well, now that we've got that out of the way, it is time for the On Your Money email box, where you can write a note if you'd like to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And we've got an email here from Ed. And here's what Ed has to say. We need a second opinion. I am retiring, and I need to choose a pension option. My wife and I each anticipate getting pensions, and we have significant savings such that our pensions will not be critical to our maintenance. Should we still consider a pension option that provides survivor benefits, or should we maximize our payments in early retirement by choosing annuitant only? Well, wow, some big questions there, Kevin.
It really is. And even, you know, not everyone is subject to a pension system in retirement, but almost all of us are subject to Social Security. And the questions are very similar for both of those topics. The rule of thumb right now is that if you are going to be retiring and you do have the option of taking a pension and or Social Security, it's typically better to take as much as you can get right now, sooner rather than later. First of all, it allows you to maintain any savings that you have for a lump sum emergency cost. Like, let's say you have an uncovered medical expense that it's going to cost you $50,000. It's difficult to say to the Social Security Administration or the pension company to say, you know what, I drew down all my pension or all my savings while I was delaying payments. Can you send me the next 48 checks I should hopefully receive? Second of all, it gives you money that you have available to invest. If interest rates should go up, you can buy a new CD at 4% or 5%. Or if the stock market goes down, you can get reinvest in at lower prices as well. And finally, and this is the most important one in these times, as I perceive it, is you know where the money is. When you take your pension and your Social Security, that check is in your hand right now. You can do whatever you want with it, and you know exactly where it is, and you have total control over it. And that's not the case if you're delaying benefits in the hopes of getting a higher check down the road.
And one of the things Ed brought up is this issue of survivor benefits.
Right, and that is a tougher question. It's an easy one to answer as long as you tell me exactly how long you're going to live and how long the second person is going to live and what's going to happen to the pension check in the meantime. Otherwise, it's more of a gray area, and it's difficult for some people to think about it. If you do have long life expectancy, good health, your parents live to a long age, and you have good income and assets, it might be better to wait and take the higher benefit down the road. But if you do need the money, and more importantly, if you do have some health issues, take the 100% benefit right now. And if you're in good health, see if you can buy some life insurance. That's usually a relatively small amount can cover the difference between what would be lost if either one of the members of a couple might pass away.
Yeah, and how much less expensive is it for the surviving member of a couple?
As a rule of thumb, when I've worked with people, I've done this now for 24 years, and generally, when a couple retires, when one person passes away, I find that the survivor's expenses go down about $1,000, and it typically is about $500 a month in less, you know, food and miscellaneous expenses, and another $500 less in medical costs. So it's about $1,000 a month less. So if Ed can have get his pension to the point where, you know, if there's a survivor, the survivor just loses $1,000 per month, that's a pretty good place to be.
All right, let's take a break right now, and when we come back, we will be getting to your calls in just a few moments. 800-642-1234. We do have a couple open lines for you. If you've got a question or a comment for Kevin, it is 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. It's On Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money. Give me some money.
It's 19 minutes past 8 o'clock on Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gene Purcell along with Kevin McKinley. Inviting your calls, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If you've got a question for Kevin or a comment that you'd like to share with us. We're going to start out this morning with a call from Dennis, who joins us from Prescott. Good morning.
Good morning. Your guest had said something about being able to pull money out of a Roth at any time for anything. My understanding was that you had to wait at least 5 years after contributing to be able to pull anything out of a Roth. And I just wanted to get an answer to that.
Thanks for the call. And Kevin, what about that?
Well, there is a rule. It's actually a very tricky rule about Roth IRAs and as pertaining to a five-year rule. But the contribution portion, Dennis, can always be pulled out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. So let's say you put $5,000 into a Roth IRA right now, and it grows to $6,000. And then within, let's say, a couple of years, you say, oh, shoot, I need that money. You can pull the $5,000 back out and pay no taxes or penalties on it. And the good people at the IRS let you designate that $5,000 as the contribution portion. It's when you pull the $1,000 of earnings out that you can start to create some problems in the forms of taxes and penalties. And even then, after the money has been in the Roth IRA for a certain period of time and it's in retirement after 59 and a half, then you can pull the whole thing out with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. But the contribution portion is what can be pulled out with no taxes or penalties at all.
All right. So that money you put in, pretty safe. To take it back out. The tricky part is after you've got some earnings building up there.
That's right. And okay. It is why I recommend that people who, you know, generally people who are struggling financially are going to be in a lower tax bracket. So the money that is going in on a Roth IRA, you don't get the tax break right now. But because you're in a lower tax bracket, it probably isn't as important. What is important is that you actually are able to set something aside. And a lot of people are uncomfortable doing that because they say, I know I need to save for retirement, but in a couple of years, I might need this money for an emergency. So I'm hesitant to do it. The Roth IRA allows you to do it and get the contribution portion back out whenever you want if an emergency should arise.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Let's move on to Franklin right now, and Tony joins us. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about annuities again. I called you a while ago. This is a new one by Vanguard. It's a variable annuity. Mm-hmm. If I invest $100,000 in it, I can withdraw 4.5% each year. If the value of the annuity increases, I can withdraw more. If it decreases, I still can withdraw $4,500. If I don't withdraw it, my percentage decreases. The cost of this annuity is between 1.45 and 1.55 per year. If I don't withdraw this annuity, I could save 1% about. This annuity is used in different investments. One is the Vanguard Wellington, which is a good conservative investment. It charges 0.6% per year, or it could invest in combination stocks and bonds. So do you think this might be worth it for me who doesn't like to always watch the stock market?
That's a great question. I'm glad you called Tony from Franklin, although I do get confused. I can never remember if it's Tony from Franklin or Franklin from Tony. It is Tony from Franklin. Okay, good. Yes, and I this is a relatively new development. Is Vanguard coming out with not only an annuity, but an annuity that has what's called a guaranteed minimum income benefit?
Yes.
And You're one of my favorite kinds of annuity purchasers, Tony, because you sound like you've actually done some homework on this. And a lot of times people who buy annuities buy them on the word of a person who's a financial salesperson and for better or for worse is getting paid commission to sell the person that. And sometimes the truth about it or the negatives can be lost in the discussion or not discussed at all. So you sound like you've gone into this pretty deeply. The concern I would have is the expenses, in that if you have a conservative investment and let's say 1.5 to 2% of that investment is being eaten up by expenses and fees, you know, if we go into an environment where going forward, Tony, we might only make, let's say, 5% a year in the stock market, which wouldn't surprise me at all over the next 10 years, and 2 or 3% of that money is eaten up by some kind of annuity, or even 2% in the one that you're discussing, that gets you down to about 3 or 4% and then I have a net return. And then I start to say, well, then if that's the net return, what's the benefit of paying all these expenses on there? I don't dislike annuities in and of themselves. I think they're way oversold to people. I think a lot of people purchase them and don't understand the negatives and the costs and the drawbacks. If I were to purchase an annuity, I think this is, and I needed one that had a guaranteed minimum income and benefit, this is probably one of the first ones I would consider. It is fairly new, so we'll see what happens with it going forward. But I don't mind this within the scope of just variable annuities with guaranteed income benefits, if that's a convoluted enough answer for you.
Sure. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, Tony, thanks for your call, and it was definitely Tony from Franklin and not Franklin from Tony, just so we
got
all
it.
Have that straight. Good. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number. If you've got a question or a comment for Kevin McKinley, it's On Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to Bob now, and Bob is with us from Madison. Good morning, Bob.
Hi, good morning. Sticking with stocks and bonds, are you there, sir?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. I'm a senior, and I've done my own taxes. I've done my own taxes for over 60 years, if you can believe that or not. So I usually get to publication 17, and I find, is there any way to get around the Schedule D requirements? Because now, this year, in their wisdom, I see the government, to simplify the tax code, supposedly come out with a new form that you have to fill out, and you have to wade through 14 pages of instructions if you only trade stocks once or twice a year.
You're referring to capital gains,
yes,
Bob?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You might trade 2 or 3 times a year, have 2 or 3 gains and maybe a loss.
Okay.
And now you've got to come up with a form 8949, they call it.
Right. We're going to be talking about that. The IRS is asking for an increase in information on cost basis and sales proceeds of, stocks, all investments, but mostly stocks and mutual funds, because they just want to verify that all the correct amounts are being reported and the money is being paid. So this is going to be a year of increased paperwork for people like you, Bob, and people like me who are in the financial advice business. There's really no way around it. You're always going to get this information when you have any transactions. What I would ask you is, do you have any IRAs or Roth IRAs that you set up in the past?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What you might want to do, if your biggest issue is reporting of the actual transactions, is sell what you have in 2012 and wait 30 days and then purchase those same securities in the IRA and the Roth IRA. And if you can do that, then you can still make the same transactions, and you not only have to, you can avoid paying taxes on it for the time being, but you avoid reporting it as well.
I don't understand, because when you're a senior and you have no income, you know, that you would report from wages and earnings, if you get that capital gain is not an earning, I guess, as far as the government is concerned.
No. I'm saying you have assets within an IRA right now, right?
Right.
Okay. Instead of buying and selling stocks outside of an IRA, buy and sell them inside of the IRA. Then you can still own the stocks, and you don't have to worry about it. And put the money from that you have that are currently in your stocks that are generating this need for a Schedule D, put that in, you know, CD or you know, even an annuity. I don't recommend annuities, but if your biggest cause is or your biggest concern is avoiding the reporting of the taxation, you might want to do your stock trading inside of the IRA and the Roth IRA. And then again, that not only shelters taxes, but it also means you don't have to report it. Like, instead of buying the stocks where they are right now, sell them. Yes, you have to report the gains and losses for 2012's tax year, but you have 16 months to do that. And then once you've done that, then start doing any buying and selling you have with the money that you have that's currently in an IRA or Roth IRA.
Bob, thanks so much for the call, and good luck with all that. Now, Kevin, I have a quick question on this Form 8949. It's new this year. Do you think that a lot of folks are aware of it, or is it going to catch people by surprise?
No, like a lot of tax things, and again, we mentioned it earlier in the show, but every time there's some new big push, it usually hits people when they actually go to file their taxes, which for many people is in February or March, and this will be one. It does require extra diligence and extra monitoring and reporting, and we are going to talk about it over the next few weeks.
All right, so we'll be paying attention to that. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you would like to join in. We've got a listener email here for Kevin. Our projected Social Security retirement benefits based on the assumption that you will continue to make the same income going forward. So, for example, what if your income drops for several years prior to retirement?
Yeah, they're based on your highest 35 years of earnings. That's the good and the bad news. And for many people, even if their income does drop in their 40s or 50s or 60s, it's still more money than they made in their 20s or 30s. So it doesn't affect it. But yes, the projections are based on those, on the notion that you are, if you're earning $55,000 a year, let's say right now, that you are going to earn that amount continually. It's not if you drop, let's say, from $55,000 to $45,000, the drop in and of itself is fairly small in regards to how it affects your Social Security. And again, this is one of 35 years of earnings, so it doesn't have a huge effect. But yes, it can have a bigger effect on your Social Security contribution.
800-642-1234, our toll-free number. Speaking of Social Security, we've got a question from Edith, who joins us from Waukesha. Hi.
Hi. My question is, after a person applies for Social Security, either at age 62 or at age 65, how long does it take to receive the first check?
It's typically, from the last that I've checked on this, it's the month. You have to have the benefits for a full month. You have to be eligible for it as well. So if you have to be, let's say you're 62, and you'll receive the first benefit, it's in the month following the month for which they're due. So you generally, if you were eligible, let's say in January, if you're turning 62, for the full month of January, you'll get your first check in February. There are a lot of different filing and schedule details that can affect that amount. Are you thinking about taking this money sooner, Edith?
I am not 62. I was 62 some time ago, and it has still bothering me that I turned 62 in March, and I didn't get the first Social Security check until August.
Hmm.
And my husband started to take his Social Security at 65, and he didn't get it for several months. And it just seems to me that it's unfair because people are counting on that money. And I did go to the Social Security office, and they didn't do anything about it. And I have been taking it for several years now, and still it feels so unfair.
Hmm.
The other question that I had is on my between $800 and $900 Social Security that I get every month, my increase is going to be $3 a month. Does that make sense?
It's a, if I recall correctly, I think that's a 3.6% increase on the check So I don't think it should. I think it should actually be more than that. Where you might be getting a pushback on that is for your Medicare premium. That what a lot of people were happy who were receiving Social Security were find out they were getting a pretty nice increase on their Social Security check. The problem is their Medicare premium was going up as well along with it, which offset much, if not all, of the increase. So it, if you're looking at the net difference between it, that might be where you're coming up short.
Edith, thanks so much for the call, and good luck with all of that. And Kevin, for other listeners who might have questions about Social Security matters, because it can get awfully complicated out there, I know, is there a good website that you direct people towards when it comes to that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Thank you, Gene. It's ssa.gov, ssa.gov. And the Social Security people are very helpful. They're very good in terms of planning and, you know, at least in terms of saying, well, if you do this, then you get this, and if you do that, then you get that. Where it leaves a lot of people in the dark is when they say, well, okay, what about the rest of my money or the rest of my picture? And so because there are tax and investment and income consequences to taking Social Security at a specific age, typically it's a good idea to consult the people at Social Security and then take everything that you have and figure out on your own to say, well, in the bigger picture, from where should I get this money and when? And it's a very complex question. Again, we'll be discussing that over the next few weeks.
Indeed. And if you've got a question for Kevin, give us a call at 800-642-1234. We'll be taking some calls again in just a few minutes. 800-642-1234. We've got some open lines for you right now if you'd like to get in on that. 800-642-1234. And Kevin, it is time for the smart assets portion of the program. This time around, we're talking about New Year's resolutions. Of course, everybody is. So if you're looking to make a financial New Year's resolution, turns out you might want to think a little bit differently about what you resolve to do this year.
Yes, and how you plan to do it. Weight loss is always the most off-sighted resolution people take. But spending less is typically the next one that people talk about here. Not everybody needs to worry about spending less, though, and some people should actually prioritize a few other financial goals that they might have.
All right, we've got those other goals, but let's start with that idea of spending less.
Okay, well, you can't know if you are spending less if you don't know what you're spending. And this is something in my private practice, what I see with people who are in good financial shape. They're typically, it's almost a hobby for them to track where their money is coming from and, most importantly, where it's going. So write down where all of your money is going for a month. And once you get a better idea about where it's going, you can decide what can be cut, if anything. And then this is a trick I've adopted with people in the past is when you say, you know what, I go through, you know, I use my ATM, I use my debit cards, I use my credit cards, and I don't know where all the money goes until the end of the month. I get the bills and the statements back, and I say, oh my gosh, I spent that much money. I wish I wouldn't have done that. Well, once you figure out your necessary expenses, start carrying cash with you. And I've done this myself just as an exercise. If you walk into a store with $20 and that's all you have on you, you don't have a debit card, you don't have a credit card, guess how much you're going to spend? No more than $20 for sure, because the store won't let you spend any more than that. Another effective tool, if you are trying to resolve to spend less money, is to pull a person into the equation. You know, if you have a partner or spouse or a friend, you say, you know what, I want to spend some less money this year. Would you do me a favor? Would you just kind of hold me accountable so I can report into you what I'm spending and you can just kind of check off on it and monitor? And the good thing is, if you are married or in a committed relationship, that person has been dying to tell you all the dumb things that you spend money on. So usually they'll be more than happy to help you out.
I'll bet. So that's something you want to use a certain amount of caution on, I imagine. But let's say you get through all of that and you need more. You'd like to make a bigger reduction to your spending.
Then I would suggest that you consider, if you're working anyway, bump up your retirement plan contributions. One of the easiest ways to painlessly reduce the amount of money that's coming into your checking account to see if you can afford it. The new limits for 2012, you can contribute up to $17,000 to 401ks and 403bs, and then another $5,500 on top of that for catch-up contributions. Again, you'll cut your taxes by about 20 to 30 cents for every dollar you put into one of those plans, and it's still your money. It's still going into an account in your name. No one can take that away from you, and you can always change back. And so one thing I'd recommend for people who want to save more money is to start out, let's say, by contributing 10%. 10% of your salary to a pre-tax retirement plan at work, and then cut back 1% every single month until you get to a level of comfort. And even if you cut it back all the way to zero after 10 months, you'll still get about 5% of your salary into a pre-tax retirement plan.
Now, we've been talking about spending less here, but earlier you said not everybody needs to do that. So what do you mean when you say not everybody needs to worry about spending less?
This is something I run into a lot in my practice, and part of it is because I run into it with people who are in their 50s and 60s, and these people generally have more money than time, and they a lot of times don't even know that they're financially secure enough where they can actually start spending money on things that matter to them. And once we get past a certain age, even if we live into our 80s and 90s, even if we're in decent health, we just don't have the interest or the energy to pursue things like trips, or you know, to buy that car we've always had our eye on, or do something for someone special. So again, we'll talk more about this down the road, but the rough rule of thumb is to take your net monthly expenses and use that as the basis for measuring how you're doing financially, and if you can afford to spend money on things that might be a little more frivolous. So, for instance, if in your 40s, as long as you have about 100 times your net monthly expenses, again, this is after what you expect to receive in Social Security or a pension. In your 50s, maybe 150 times that amount, and in your 60s, maybe 200 times that amount. And I would really encourage people to spend the difference, because I can't make any guarantees about, you know, how long your brain or your eyes or your ears or your knees are going to allow you to enjoy this money. And if you need to set up a little separate account, let's say someone, you know, retires in good shape with several hundred thousand dollars, well, set up an account with $10,000 or $20,000 in, and know that you can spend all of that. And as long as there's money in there, that it is spendable. So if those people need to actually spend it while they can enjoy it.
All right, good things to remember. We're going to be taking a break in just a few moments here, but before we do that, we've got time for a quick phone call, and we're going to head out this time to Mazamani, and Jessica is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Kevin. I have a question about a mortgage offer that we have. We've been trying to refinance our loan for 2 years, and we've had a litany of issues with it because we have a rural property and prices have gone down. And we finally are able to go ahead and do that and be a 30-year FHA loan. But at the same time, I just received an offer from our current mortgage holder, which is Citibank. And they said, hey, you can refinance with us for 20 years at 4.25%, and there's no closing costs. It's part of that new federal government program. And so there's no appraisal, no closing costs. And if we go with the FHA loan, we, of course, have closing costs, and we'll also have private mortgage insurance because our value of our home has decreased. And so for about 2 or 3 years, we'll have private mortgage insurance. So there's a lot more cost with that one, but it is a 30-year loan versus the 20-year loan offer with Citibank.
Okay.
So I was wondering if you have advice for us.
Sure. What is the rate on the 30-year loan?
Our mortgage guy is coming out right now this week, and I don't know the exact amount, but he said it's really close to 4%.
Okay.
So I assume it'd be very comparable to the 4.25.
Okay. And the Citibank offer, is that something that you know you can get, or was that just the print in the mailer that you received?
No, we've actually been approved for it. I have confirmation of that, and they said they'll send out their closing packet, but we can cancel before at any time before we sign it. So I'm not on the hook for that at all.
Okay. Offhand, I lean toward the longer mortgage, and especially if you still can get it that 4 to 4.5% rate. And here's why. Yes, you may have to pay some private mortgage insurance, but you will still have a much lower payment with that 30-year mortgage than you will with a 20-year mortgage. And with a 30-year mortgage, there's generally no prepayment penalties. So if you decide for whatever reason after a few years, you say, you know what, we're feeling really flush, we've got everything taken care of financially, all that we have hanging out there is this mortgage, let's start paying this off faster. If you make the payment that the 4.25 one from Citibank would have required, you'll still pay the 30-year mortgage off in about 20 and a half to 21 years. But if for whatever reason, either from a personal basis or from an economic basis, let's say interest rates go up to 6 or 7%, you'll be very happy that you have this mortgage locked in for 4% or so for a much longer time, because the payment will be lower. You can use any extra proceeds to invest or spend it on more urgent needs than just making your mortgage payment and getting it paid off.
Okay, so it seems best even with all those extra fees to go with that 30-year mortgage.
Yeah, it stinks, and it will so for a few years, but hopefully, you've got 3 decades to enjoy that mortgage, and you'll have forgotten about this long after you're still paying on the 30-year one. And again, because if there was some provision, Jessica, where, the bank said, hey, if you pay this off early, we're going to ding you $10,000 or $20,000, I'd be much more hesitant to take that 30-year out. But since the freedom is always on your side, you control the shots as to how that gets paid off, as long as you make the minimum payment. I'd rather have you go with a longer one and then pay it off early if you get flush and win the lottery.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, Jessica, thank you for the call. We're going to be talking about some things to do about Christmas. That's right, Christmas season isn't quite over just yet, and we'll be taking care of that business after this break. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Greenback paper bill.
14 minutes before 9 o'clock. It's On Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell here with Kevin McKinley, and we're talking about the holidays. So even as the holidays are winding down right now, Kevin, it doesn't mean that our Christmas duties are done.
Nope, we still have some things to do. Make sure your Christmas presents don't turn into lumps of coal. And you can start by, you got that thing sitting under the tree that somebody didn't want. Maybe it's you, maybe it's someone you gave it to and for whom you are responsible. But you probably want to take that back. According to the National Retail Federation, about $400 per household of items are going to be taken back in this post-holiday season. The good news is that more stores are willing to accept those returns, especially if you are willing to exchange them for other items and maybe even spend a little bit more money than you did before the holiday. The bad news is there are shorter time periods right now. Many retailers have shrunk the window in which they will take back returns, and this is especially important if you bought this gift during the Black Friday or Cyber Monday or Shrove Tuesday or whatever all these different shopping holidays that are out there. So you definitely want, if you are returning something, you want to get it back as soon as possible. Consumersworld.org/returns. has a link up to all the different major retailers' return policies, and we'll have that site up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And I'm assuming that we'll need to produce receipts to return items?
It will be helpful, and especially if you do want cash back instead of just exchanging it for a different size or another item of a similar nature, you should definitely save those in a safe place. But there's a service that's a free service called OneReceipt.com, OneReceipt.com, that allows you not only to scan in the receipts and store them digitally, it also tracks your online receipts that have been emailed to you for online purchases. And it's a free service that allows you not only to keep your receipts all in one place, but know where the expirations are coming up so you don't miss out on the return policy of a given retailer.
OneReceipt.com. That is a very cool tip. Now, one of the things you've talked about in the past, I know, are warranties. Are those automatically activated when I buy whatever electronic item I've purchased?
Some of them can be. Some of them, the coverage starts at the minute that you put it into use. But others, you do have to register. So it's better if there is some kind of registration to go online, or even there are still some. If you got a toaster, there's probably a card that came in there that you have to register via regular mail. And not only does it allow you to qualify for the full warranty coverage, but you will get information on any updates and any patches or any recalls on the particular item. So, yeah, it's a drag to do it, but it's definitely something you want to do if you're concerned about the thing breaking down the road.
Now, one of the things I got this year was some gift cards, and those are pretty cool because the great thing about giving and, of course, getting those is that nobody ever brings them back. They just, they're out there.
Yeah, and the more general it is, the more likely it is that it won't be returned, but you still have to keep an eye on them. Households, again, according to the National Retail Federation, purchased about $250 each in gift cards for this holiday season. You definitely want to register the card in the number or the website that's on the back of the card or the receipt that came with it in case it's lost or stolen. Watch any inactivity or activity fees. Wisconsin gift card law is subject to basically federal gift card law, and those can't be kicked in usually till after the first year. But between the nature of many retailers and a lot of these fees and the fine print and the fact that you may lose it or forget about it, you should probably plan on using this sooner rather than later. And if you you either don't want it or you want to find a good deal on other people's gift cards, go to plasticjungle.com. That's a good place you can sell gift cards for usually about 80 to 90 cents for every dollar of stored value.
Wow, that's a lot to plasticjungle.com. I'm going to make a note of that, too. Before I forget, though, any more jobs to do?
Absolutely, and especially if, like me, you are in charge of some wee ones, get those thank you notes out. And this is not a, you know, an email or a text message. Get a real thank you card out. Have them write it out. The older the recipient of the thank you card is, the more likely it is that they'll appreciate it. And you can tell the kids that gratitude is one of the highest planes of existence to achieve, and it makes it more likely that you'll get more gifts next year.
All right, very good. And you suggest we use a regular car with regular mail.
Yeah, it's still available, technically.
I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, some people still do. It's a bit of an anachronism. It's quaint. But yes, write it out in a card, put it in an envelope, put a real stamp on it, and send it to the person. And they will be overjoyed to know that you not only received the gift, but that you appreciated it.
All right, very good. Well, let's head back to the phones for some more questions, some more comments. 800-642-1234, by the way. Gene joins us now from Appleton. And good morning, Gene.
Good morning. I have a question. I'm kind of frozen on it. I received a lump sum settlement and want to have a conservative portfolio since I'm old. And the current economy gives low returns. And I don't know whether it's better to use a flat fee, 1% financial planner, or one who's paid by commission on trades. And both come equally recommended. How do you make that choice in this period of low returns?
Well, I would say, Gene, the could you turn your radio down for a second?
My radio is not on.
I'll just bring her down, and maybe that'll get rid of that little echo there, Kevin. Give it another shot.
Okay, my apologies. It's really a matter of personal preference, first of all. The problem with paying a person a flat fee is that you're paying that person a flat fee almost on, you have that person on retainer where you can gather information from him or her at any given time, and they're at your disposal, and they're also responsible for helping you out. If they both come highly recommended and the person pays a commission or you pay a commission to that person, then it's a little different story than many of these situations because of a lot of times people who are on commission get this payment and then they say, you know what, I got all the payment I can. Now I got to go find somebody else to make another commission payment. But there are good financial advisors out there who do get paid on commission. And if you're comfortable with it, Gene, the good thing is this is your money, so there's no right answer to it. I guess what I would do is go to each one of them and say, what are the costs of working with you? What can I expect to pay? And not only up front, but down the road, what kind of service am I going to get from you? How often will I hear from you? Can I call you at any time for any reason, even if it's not something that has to do with either the investments you've helped me with or if it's something that's going to generate a commission for you? I'll still have financial questions or tax questions. And if the commission advisor says, no, I'll do that, you might want to give that person a shot. But otherwise, you might be looking at a fee-based arrangement instead.
Gene, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Lake Geneva now, and John joins us. Hi, John.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, okay. I'd like to commend that gentleman who did his taxes for 60 years because I've also done that, and I'm about his age. That's number one. Number two is I really like your idea of budgeting. I've kept a budget and my records for expenditures for over 50 years, and it really helps. Okay, the question I have is on this special form, I don't remember the number, 89-something, that has to do with your capital gains. If I get a H&R Block tax cut thing or a TurboTax, do you know offhand if they guide you through that?
You mean if they guide you through how to complete it and fill it out?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. That's basically all they do is they kind of walk you through a step of where they ask you a question and tell you a little bit more about how to find the information that they're requesting. And, yeah, they'll definitely cover that. And you will get more information this year, John, than you've received in previous years from any investment firms or brokerage accounts that you have on securities that have generated this type of information. So, yes, they will walk you through that. And for people like you, I commend you as well for doing what you've done, because it is one of the good ways to monitor your financial situation. But the $50 or so that it costs to buy the, you know, the tax preparation software, it's well worth it. And especially because most of the problems that come back to bite people on their taxes are not so much where they've skirted the laws or something. It's where their math isn't correct. And so one of the best services these tax software programs do is they add up the numbers and say, wait a minute, you're missing a number. This doesn't work out correctly. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend people who are still doing their own taxes get some kind of software program to help you out.
Okay. Thanks a lot, and thanks for the program.
My pleasure, John.
And John, thank you for the call. And Kevin, these programs are updated. I mean, that's their whole purpose, right? You buy a new one every year, and they've got all the latest and greatest regulations right in there.
I'm glad it's not my business, because a lot of times, you know, these laws are changed on December 17th, yeah. And people want to start working on their taxes on January 2nd. And so they not only have to be cognizant of the laws, but put them into the software so it works for everyone. So, yes, they are changed, and sometimes there are patches down the road. Or they'll say, you know what, this is something we were still waiting to do at our last update. This regulation wasn't reconciled yet, so we don't have the information for you right now. We'll let you know as soon as we do.
Let's go to George now. George is with us from Milwaukee. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I wonder if I could just get your opinion on investing in treasury bonds or I-bonds.
Are you talking about TIPS, like inflation-protected treasuries, or Series I savings bonds?
I guess the savings bonds, although I don't really know the difference.
Sure. There isn't a whole lot of difference on the surface. The ones I like better are the Series I savings bonds, and the reason being is that there is very little downside risk to those bonds. I think they pay about 3.06% for 6 months right now, and they usually change the rates. New rates come out every May 1st and November 1st. There is no state tax on the interest. There is a penalty if you pull the money out between 12 months and 5 years after you buy the bond, George, but it's only 3 months' worth of interest. After five years, there's no penalty whatsoever, and between the safety and the state tax exemption, and you can also decide, George, when you declare the interest on those bonds, meaning you can declare it every single year or and pay taxes on it, or you can let it roll until you actually redeem the bonds and then pay taxes at that time. So you get some flexibility that way as well. People who are interested in these can go to treasurydirect.gov and get more information. The bad news about Series I bonds, after the first of the year a couple days ago, they changed the policy. Before, you could buy $5,000 per person in person every single year and another $5,000 online every single year. Now you can only get the online option, the electronic option at treasurydirect.gov. So they've said they've done this to save us $70 million of cost for processing paper series savings bonds. My guess is it's more so that these were such a good thing that they were worried people were taking too much advantage of it, so they wanted to scale back the limits even further.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, George, thanks for the call. And Kevin, on that online purchase, that's limited to $5,000 then? They didn't just bump it up?
Nope, that's right, Gene. That was one of the sad things about this. I hoped they would do that, bump it up so you could buy $10,000 online. But as I understand it, it's just $5,000 now per person per year online.
All right. Before we go, we've talked about a lot of websites, but what's your pick for the website of the week?
This is gympact.com, gym-pact.com, and it's an interesting concept for people who want to lose weight and suffer some financial pain if they don't. You basically download an app onto your smartphone, register how many times you want to visit the gym
per week, and then the phone tracks whether you actually go to the gym. If you go, you don't lose any money. If you don't go, you lose $5 for every time. And better yet, if you make all of the times you've told the service you want to make it, you get money from the other people who haven't made it.
Wow, that's so crazy. It just might work. Well, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
All right, Kevin McKinley, thanks so much for joining us. Kevin McKinley on Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.